You're listening to Tech Recruit, a podcast that educates talent acquisition and recruitment professionals on innovation to attract talent across all industries. We're glad you're here.
Welcome, everybody, to our premiere show of Talent Analytics. My whole goal for everybody is to empower you to not use opinions, but to use data to back you up. And that is going to make you exponentially more valuable to your company. And the stories we're going to talk about in all these shows every Wednesday, 9 a.m., are actual data sets that companies have used for making change, making decisions, and they're going to talk to you about where they pulled that data, the reasons they pulled that data, and how they put it together. We're so excited to have you here, and today we have Todd Davis. He is the Global Talent Acquisition Leader for IBM. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, thanks, and thanks for everyone for joining.
Yes. Actually, Todd has been with me for quite some time. We've been working with each other. He was the keynote at the Orange County Tech Recruit Conference, and he's also on the board of advisors for the Tech Recruit Conference, where we meet like once a month with all of our other talent acquisition leaders to discuss moving forward with the conference and the content and all the great things that we're doing. So this show is so very important to talent acquisition. We're talking about COVID-19. We're talking about the changes. We're talking about looking at data. And tell us about what our topic is today.
You know, we're talking about analytics and this idea about using data to tell the story, to hopefully predict the future, you know, to be able to use the things that we know intuitively and the things that we don't know, and use data and analytics to begin to navigate and influence and be able to tell those stories. We hear about these topics all the time. Analytics, you know, I've got data, I'm data centric, et cetera. But the fact is, most of the time, these things are just metrics. People, you know, things that people are measuring that have happened, that have already been agreed to, that are done. And honestly, that's where we're getting the difference. We want to move away from just looking at a dashboard and saying, oh, this is how we did last quarter, how we did last month, or how that went. We want to be able to start using that information to talk about the now, the how we're doing, what we're going to be able to do, and predict what's going to happen. That's what analytics is really all about. It's about moving from looking at data and letting the data drive us to using data and using analysis to help us make better decisions. That's what we're all about. That's what I'm going to try to show today with a specific focus on one thing. I really want to make sure people realize that data is also very, very, very difficult to advocate for. You can give someone a giant Excel spreadsheet and they're going to look at it and they're going to say, oh, this is great. So much data. I love it. When you do that, you're handing off the story. It's like you imagine yourself on a stage and you're the MC and you say, this is the great show. Here it is. And then you walk away. And then everyone watches the show or looks at it and comes away with their own idea. The opportunity with analytics is to be able to help narrate the story, to tell the story, to make sure people know that, look, this is what's important in this data, and this is what we need to be able to do. That's what gives you a seat at the table to have a data-driven approach and use those analytics to help tell that story. And that's hopefully what I'm going to be able to show you today are some examples of things. So a couple of real-world stories from over the past several years, looking at these cases where data was influential, but also being able to help me and other members people that I was working with tell a story that was impactful so that we could move forward into the future, not just live in the last quarter.
This is exactly what we're talking about today. So I'll turn it over to you, Todd, and I'll let you take it away. And again, real quickly, I've noticed everybody in the chat is actually responding only to myself and Todd. If you look at the drop down at the top where you type your message, it says all panelists and attendees. Make sure you're selecting that so all of us, all the attendees see what you're saying too. All right, awesome. Take it away, Todd.
All right, let's go. Rather than just walk you through Excel spreadsheets or data as an audience, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be able to show you the snapshots in the interest of time. It's really not interesting to look at things that are just scrolling and watching Excel compile or things like that. Your time is too valuable. What I want to be able to show you are some of the inputs and the outcomes and how this data worked and how these analytics work and the goals to achieve and be able to take those questions and have that information as we move forward. So we're going to go forward from there. So here's what we're going to cover. I want to talk about, you know, what is analytics? Why does it matter? We started that conversation and we'll focus on that. We're going to talk through some smaller examples of things to sort of illustrate what's going on. But then we're really going to focus on two big ideas, two issues. One was I call the classic, where we had hiring managers and teams that just were arguing, saying we need more candidates. We just need more candidates. And I think a lot of us who've been recruiting for a while have been in those situations. And then the last example we'll talk about is this new history, the current idea, how COVID-19 is impacting hiring and some of the ways that we used, you know, data and analytics to sort of understand what was really going on in the market. And not only that, but also to help us decide what we were going to do next and how we're going to face this in the future to help us continue to drive our talent acquisition and our talent group. So that's kind of the idea. Let's talk a little bit about these two ideas. I want to just kind of recalibrate for everybody. There's metrics and analytics. They are very closely related, but they are different. When you look at metrics, you're talking about numbers that you track. And these are all these ideas. Recruiting is very, very, very measured. It's one of the most measured functions in HR because it has most of the activity. It has most of the actions that are tangible that can actually be measured and accounted for. And you've got those ad hoc measures, benchmarking. You get to systems and portals, and then you finally come almost full circle into scorecards, dashboards, and drill downs. But at the end of the day, when you look at these things, these are all basically drivers for metrics that have already been done. They're agreed to, you know, the time to fill or even NPS scores. These are measures that they're sophisticated. They can be complicated. They have value, but they're not really necessarily helping you or empowering you as a recruiter to engage in the conversation. You know, one of my favorite examples is people tell me that some people make these observations. They say, oh, time to hire went from 65 days to 60 days. We're doing great. And I always kind of bristle at that because I say, look, just because you're 5 days faster doesn't mean you're better. There's so many opportunities in that in and of itself, but it's a number that looks like it's supposed to be good. So people think, hey, we're faster. That's got to be good. That can be a whole plethora of problems. When we get into analytics, now we're talking about this idea, this concept about using data to make decisions, to talk about how we're going to really think about what's going on to build those up. And when you think about analytics, there's, you know, these kind of these ideas. There's, you know, the idea about correlation. This is probably the most straightforward one there is. You know, being able to see the relationship between one idea and the impact it has and what it's influencing. Looking at root causes, using that data and that correlation or that information to say what's really going on there. You know, what's really happening there? And then forecast predictions, really saying, hey, look, what does this mean if we do this, if we push this lever, if we, you know, accelerate this or do that, what's that likely to going to do for us? And then we can validate and test. And that leads us right into that idea about optimization, taking all those correlations, the understanding of root causes, using our forecasts and predictions and moving into actually doing better. You know, an interesting example, I think, was I was having a discussion at Ancestry about when I was there about building the team, about modeling recruiters. And what I did was I walked through the idea that with this many recruiting cycles, you know, we have say 60 days, gives you so many cycles in a year. We were able to really numerize and really quantify how much the load on a recruiter actually could be for an in-house recruiter to be effective, to be really able to do that, be able to predict what that meant, and then extrapolate that number, that algorithm from one recruiter to, oh, okay, let's talk about that means 10 recruiters or 20 recruiters to do this number of output. That's where we start to see this conversation. And the feedback I got from the people I was working with, and they were the FP&A team in the finance group there, they said, so no one's ever actually showed us what a recruiter capacity model is. We like that. That's something that's helpful, because before, all we got was requests for more headcount or agency money, and they couldn't really understand why the team needed it. Being able to build a business case to say, well, this is what a recruiter can do. This is what they're capable of doing. And here's how many we need. Just do the math. Once we get that into this idea of concept, then we can think about levers to say, oh, well, if a recruiter can do this, what if we ask them not to do that? What if we streamline that task or streamline that? Can that give us more? How can we build that? And suddenly you're going from a correlation of one idea to another to bringing it full circle to optimizing. And then suddenly you've got output and numbers. And that's the difference. You can't get there through just looking at numbers. If I just said, hey, it takes 65 days to fill a job, we can get it to 60 days. Great. There's not that much you can do with that unless you can show the relationship between what's going on. So keep that in mind. Metrics, numbers you track, analytics. So when we move from the descriptive after the fact and preconceived notions, we get into those predictive, proactive opportunities where they're really also, and this is important, they're unbiased. Data tells its own story. You're going to hear me say that a lot, this conversation. And it doesn't really lie in and of itself. The old aphorism that statistics lie, that's not what it is. It's the statistics don't lie, statisticians do. It's when we look at numbers, we can start to build our own stories and put them in. So let me give you an example of that. Let me talk about what's going on here. We think about analytics. Keep in mind, within that idea, we've talked about what they are now. There's these ideas here, and then there's these ideas. These are the types of analytics. Now, this is not 100% complete. There's more different terms you can look on. You can just Google types of analytics, and you'll see all sorts of different relationship descriptions. But there's really three big concepts that I think. This is how I define them. Descriptive, predictive, and prescriptive. The descriptives, those are the what has happened. They look at, you know, you can use Excel, you can look at the SPS, Stata, all these examples of tools. And you start to get information on what happened, what went on when we did that search, or last year, how many, who did we hire, et cetera, et cetera. Then you get in the predictive. That's what could happen. Now, this is when you start using software and some of the more advanced math and these formulas and the relationships. You talk about, you know, that's when you get into Python and R and SAS tools. Some of you may be familiar with those, some of you may not. I'm not going to get into a big discussion today about specific tools or how to do certain things. I'll talk a little bit about Excel later on because it has some cool features. And I'll be honest, Excel's pretty much available everywhere. You know, when we face budget constraints, things like that, and you start asking for tools, that's when people start wondering what you're doing as a recruiter. But you know, if you can, the better it is in terms of price, the more likely you are to be able to use it. So that's just sort of my approach there. But when you talk about those predictive ideas, getting those numbers in, making sure that you've got good data, good information, and relationships that are defined, you can start to see, hey, what if we did this? What's going to be the outcome? And you can experiment. And experimentation is really important. And then lastly, we get into this really big concept about prescriptive. So this takes us from the what has happened to the what could happen into the now what should we do about it? You can start to see really big ideas that you can model and formulate. You know, there's some simple things that you can do without the power of computers or cloud-based tools. You could say, well, what happens if we put another recruiter in? You know, I had this similar discussion at Amazon and at Ancestry, where we said, hey, we have this many recruiters, so we know the model. Todd talked about that. So if let's add a recruiter and see what that does for us. And then I would be that guy who would say, I know you're listening to what I just said. That's great. But I also, you want to bear in mind, there's a diminishing return. There's this idea that every recruiter that you put in to put in 25 jobs or 50 jobs, they may not necessarily get that much return. There may be inefficiencies. There may be levels of jobs. Maybe one recruiter is working on entry-level roles and one recruiter is working on executive search. The model isn't perfect. You have to put in some factors and consider those. So you start getting into nuances. And that's where some of these prescriptive tools, especially when you're operating at a very large scale, can really start to show some of the ideas. You can see, oh, okay, what if we did this? What if the model was this? One of the things we've done at IBM is around this idea about weighting. The discussion was constantly about, well, some jobs are easier to fill than others or have more volume. So we've made this attempt to ongoing this build in the model of weighting to say, oh, this position is worth one. A different position is worth 1.5 or even two. So that when you have recruiter workloads, if someone's working on 50 level one jobs, then they have 50. But if someone else is working on 25 level two jobs, they also have 50, 25 times two. So you're not saying to someone, oh, we only have 25 jobs versus that person who has 50. It's understanding, hey, there's more nuance. And that gets more complex modeling and these ideas about time and location. Maybe there's all these variables. And that's what prescriptive analytics do, help you build that up and move that forward. So this is my how-to guide. This is what I like to think about when I think about how do you use data? How do you use analytics? And there's kind of these four basic ideas. I've seen similar ideas like this related to, you know, in different fields. I didn't invent this, but this is a lot of this is my language and things that I try to tell people. And it's, I look at it in these four steps. There's data, there's hypotheses, there's analyzing and analyze, and then there's act. So there's at the top there, I put, these are the basic rules. Data, collect everything you can. Don't leave anything out. Why? It's cost neutral. Getting data basically means you're just getting data. There's things in there that you can, that you need to collect. The challenge, of course, is when you, you know, is the data clean? You know, or if someone, for simple things like in a database, does it show actual dates? Does it show dates in different formats? There's cleaning that has to go on so you can do really powerful analytics. There's nothing worse than seeing an entire table of, say, with a date that says 1/1/20 for January 1st, 2020. And then the next line is January spelled out 2, 2020. It's annoying. Computers, although they're fast, aren't that smart, and they run into trouble organizing that. So cleaning data is the price of collecting everything. But that's really important to do. And then consider the sources. Is this important to that source alone? You know, you'll have, say, someone, one of your hiring teams come in and said, hey, we looked at all of our hires over the past year, and we found this. This is the data that we have. Now, that may be useful, but it's only important to them. That's the only assumption you can make. Maybe that data is good for them. So you always want to keep that in mind. Is this data from the entire population? Is it data from just the engineering team? Is it data from someone else? You know, one of the big advocacy conversations I have a lot is people say, well, how do they do it at IBM? Or how do they do it at Amazon? And I always say to them, so that's great. That's good benchmarking. You can understand how they do it. But it's important to understand how we are going to do it. This is, you know, what's important to us. Maybe it's exactly the same, but let's keep that in mind. Don't just copy and do that because you may be missing things. So once you've got the data and you start collecting all this data, you can really start getting an advantage by moving to the next, which is, what are the hypotheses? You know, you want to gather those anecdotal observations. And that doesn't mean have people look at the data with you. It's just having those conversations to say, what's going on? What are you experiencing? What do you feel like? You know, talk to the recruiters and they say things like, well, you know, it seems like candidates aren't telling us, you know, are changing their tone, or the hiring managers are telling us this. Those anecdotal experiences are immediate. They're the now, they can be what's happening. And that's why it's important to get them. Understand what the phenomenon is. I remember an example, there was a group a few years ago that I was working with, and the managers, they were engineers, and they said, hey, we're not getting enough external candidates. We see people and the quality is not good. The candidate external quality is no good. We did some really deep dive into the candidate flow, and here's what we found. When I looked through all the data that that group had looked at, what I saw was they were only talking to the referrals. Only people that were referrals that had someone to advocate for them were getting through the offer process. So we had strong candidates with all these great yes votes, like this person met 5 people, they all liked them, but we don't want to take a risk. When I showed them that data, the first reaction was what I call the INR, the immediate negative response. They said, well, that can't be true. And I said, look, this is the data that I gathered. These are your candidates. This is what you've done. These are the people you all interviewed and you liked them, but you didn't hire them. You didn't even make them offers. You made offers to these 3 or 4 or 5. And all of these people are referrals. The fact that you have 100 candidates and 5 people that got offers or whatever that number was, and they're only referrals, should tell you something. As an engineer, the math doesn't lie. There's something going on there. And what we want to be able to do is use those kinds of anecdotal ideas. They said, hey, the quality of our candidates is poor. We need to do that. And that helped us drive a conversation. And remember, these are time sensitive. These ideas, memories are tricky. And what's urgent now, next month, might be irrelevant. You know, I've been at that table when I've heard leaders say, look, we really need to solve this problem now. I need more talent. I need to build this team. Great. Next month. Why are we still talking about that? I've got new fires to fight. And if we didn't have this observation of information in real time, we can lose it. And there's nothing more powerful about setting priorities than when a leader says, hey, this is important now, you know, and moving that forward. That's when people are going to start changing that. So you may lose out on data collection and information if you're not quick about it. Now, a rule of thumb there, hypotheses and data go together. but don't let hypotheses drive. That's why I told that example about the hiring and the referrals. They just assumed that what they were experiencing was a low candidate flow and poor candidate external quality or external candidate quality. That was what their anecdote was, this hiring manager team. When we showed them the data, something different was going on. And that usually happens. That I find that to be the most common occurrence in problem solving. We think one thing, we look, we find out, and we discover something different in how we move forward. So you take that, take the hypotheses that you've got to help frame the question or understand that, and move to that analyze stage. What's the problem? What are we trying to solve? What is going on with this idea about that we're trying to solve for? And then let the data tell that story. Find out what's happening, look for the relationships and start testing them. Look at these ideas and say, oh, this is what the data is showing. These are the measures. Maybe that's not the problem at all. Maybe the problem we think we're trying to solve is something totally different. I used this metaphor one time. Somebody, a leader told me, he said, hey, I don't understand what you're talking about. And I said, look, leopards and cheetahs, they're both spotted cats. They look the same from a distance. That's how we're talking about problems. You look at a spotted cat from across the field, it's a leopard, it's a cheetah, pretty much the same thing. When you get super close, oh my, they're very different. They're very different animals. One is super fast and one is super stealthy and they behave differently. But honestly, from a distance, that problem looked the same. But you get a little bit more data, a little bit more information, you can see a whole different cat. And that's what's going on with some of these ideas. This is challenging though. Letting data tell the story is not easy. It is, we look at these things, we're human. We have these ideas, these biases. We just do it. We just do it naturally. It's how our brains work. And so it's important to start looking at data and say, okay, this is what it's telling me. And then once we've got the analysis, we've thought through the hypotheses with our data, we show what we know, then we can start acting. We can start thinking about sharing the findings and explaining the case. It's so much more important and impactful if you can tell someone, this is the problem, this is what we found to be the root cause, and here's the action plan we're proposing because of this. That data tied to anecdotes paints a very compelling picture. And that's what analytics is really about. You know, this idea that forming actions that align to the findings is very powerful. I think the question that a lot of people hear, especially in HR and in talent acquisition in particular, is we ask for a resource and then someone says, well, why? Why do you need that money? Or why do we need to do that? Can't we just do this? Or won't that just work? And it's that being able to tell that data story is so much more powerful than just saying, well, this is why I think this will work. And this is what my gut is telling me. Nobody likes that. Nobody wants to bet money on that. Nobody wants to do that. But when you have data, you can say to them, hey, look, every candidate we examined or a large proportion of candidates, X and Y. A good example of this thinking, and I think a culture that has it ingrained is during my experience at Amazon. They had this idea, it was a common metaphor used in problem solving called doubling down. They were very effective at saying, we found, I'll make it up. We found four drivers in our problem, 1, 2, 3, 4. And we found that 30% of our results come from number one, 20 from two, et cetera, to get the full drive. And they would say, let's double down on the first two. Let's just stop doing three and four and let's do one and two. And it was this idea that saying, even though three and four may be helpful and may be driving things, they're not getting us as much impact as the first two. So let's just do that. Incredibly effective way to drive limited resources. If you only have enough to do two things, you might as well do the top two things. You double down on that. And that's what really gives them that opportunity and how they think. That is definitely part of the process. And I think it's important here. Imagine it if you were in a situation where someone said, hey, you've got four effective things. These four actions are giving you good results. But then you're forced to choose the top two or choose the two that you really want to advocate for. It's kind of like maybe being in a little bit of a Sophie's Choice situation there. You like all four, but you can only have two or three of them. How do you make the case for which ones you're going to choose? So being able to set it up that way is important. And that's what this process will do. Using your data, driving your hypotheses, using your analytics and analyzing the data with the question you're trying to solve will inform how you can act and how you can drive for. Now, one thing, All of this process doesn't guarantee you success. I can't tell you who you're working with. I don't know who you're talking to or who you're trying to influence in your situations. Every leader is different. Every leader is, has their own point of view. That relationship you build with them over time will drive how effective this process is, like anything. But rest assured, this four-step process will take you farther, longer than just doing what you're told or just trying to work in any other way that isn't quite as data-driven. That's what I've seen over many years. People with good business cases get more done. All right. I want to give you a quick example about this. This was a question I had when I was working at Amazon. It was just a conversation. It wasn't an urgent process, but it was part of the what they call their OP process, the operating plan process. And the question was this: hey, Todd, I know you're the recruiting guy, but can you do some work or tell us about attrition? Because we want to be able to look at attrition throughout the year so we can time our hiring surges, you know, when we go to market and do big bulk hiring drives for some of the expansion, rapidly growing. And they're trying to plan for that. They really wanted to say, hey, look, how do we do that? How do we get these things drawn? How do we actually move that forward and do that? But then it was followed up by this. There was this assertion that, let me get this going. This is what they felt they knew. They said, hey, attrition, this is what we expect because we know how this goes. We've been doing this for a long time. We know what's happening. We know, you know, how this is going to go. And they felt, if you look at January to December from left to right, you know, throughout the month, they just told me, this is what you're going to see. You're going to see a somewhat of a spike in May. You're going to see it's pretty stable during the summer. We get into fall. That's when a lot of people quit. And then, you know, it stabilizes again through the end of the year. And I was thinking, okay, well, if you know what's happening, why are you asking for it? But the argument was, well, we just want to make sure we know what we're doing. And so I took this as a model. I said, okay, here's the theory. You think that there's going to be a spike in attrition, right? April, May, a small one, not much. And then it's stable the rest of the year. And then, you know, you go from there. Okay. So what I did was I asked my team, say, look, I need a spreadsheet of hiring data, but I don't need the hires. I need the resignation. I need to look at attrition. And the HR partners came back and they said, hey, well, here's the dates that people left. And I said, okay, these are the dates they terminated. And they go, yeah. I said, I want to think about something different. This is when they leave. Okay, that's important. Do we know when they quit? And they go, what do you mean? I said, when they actually turned in their resignation. Is that tracked? And one of the HR partners who ran the data said, actually, yeah, we do. We record that. The date the resignation submitted, it's submitted through the HRS system. I said, can I get that for the year? And they said, sure. So they sent me back a spreadsheet with, thousands of line items of data with, basically, I said, I don't want the names. I don't want to know who they are at this point. But what I want to know from this population is what date they submitted their resignation. And then the date they left, that's cool too, help me out, that'll be helpful. So they sent that to me and I was able to just take a look at that. Now, why did I think that? So I'm using a little bit of experience there. And I said, it's, you know, people often when they're professionals give notice, they really do. They say, hey, look, I'm gonna resign, but I'll give you 2 weeks or a month or, you know, or hey boss, I'm thinking about leaving or I've got a school to go to, I'm gonna go to grad school. There's a lot of notice. So what's really important is to understand when they actually, you know, worked up the courage or, you know, had that moment and said, look, I have to go in there and tell my manager that I'm leaving and what I'm going to do. And so this is what actually happened. When I look at the data, it's very different. And these are the dates that people actually turned in their resignations. So it's actually not flat in the first quarter. It's sort of coming down from January. It starts off very high, gets into February, and it was all over the place. There's that spike in May that they talked about. It's right there, right under the May. It says, but the actual was much higher. And then you saw this activity kind of ramping up steadily into October, November. Really weird. So there was some correlation. Like they thought about, hey, May, and then, oh, in September in the fall. But it was just a very different set of behaviors. So with this data, I walked over to some of the operations team, the leadership, the VPs of operations. And I said, hey, can you tell me what the major benchmark events are in the year? Like what happens? And they laid a couple of things out for me. And then through some other discussions, we found out really just there's three kind of events that happen. So March, this is when at that time period, they do performance reviews. So this is the end of year. This is your look, you're looking backward performance review. So attrition spikes. Then people start resigning at performance time. Maybe they didn't get a good review. Maybe they're anticipating not getting a good review. Maybe they're, you know, whatever that is, or they didn't get the promotion they expected, whatever that is. So it spikes. Then there's this one, May. For those of you who don't know that organization, that's when sign-on bonuses sunset. Many people are at their 1 and 2 year sign-on cash at Amazon, and then that's when they sunset. So basically they start to say, well, I've got my money, I'm out. And you know, they don't feel the so-called golden handcuff, or there's an opportunity there. And there's also a vesting. That's a common vesting schedule for big sign-on grants. So people basically in May turn around and exit. But then there's the other phenomenon. This is a big one for in that organization. This is the holiday rush, what they call peak. And it's very well known. It's essentially in the United States, it's Thanksgiving to the end of the year, Christmas time. Not a whole lot goes on. That whole organization is committed to delivering the holidays, you know, for you, for us, for the people who buy from that organization. This is common amongst them. So people are working a lot of hours. They're, you know, away from their families. They're making sure that all those packages get delivered. It's a big deal. So it actually makes sense intuitively that right there in October, November, people are looking at peak, looking at the holiday rush, and they're saying, I can't do it. I don't want to do that. I've done it here. Or I'm not up for it. Or I need to leave before so that I can maybe resign in before peak and let them know that I'm not going to be here, but work through it. That's a very common thing. A lot of them are very professional, very dedicated, and they say, hey, boss, I'm going to leave, but don't worry. I'm going to be here through peak. You just won't see me, you know, sort of in the, in you know, when we're done. Next quarter, I'm going to be gone or do whatever after the holidays. It's very different. I remember showing the top graph to some of the folks in a white paper, and they said, well, this is ridiculous. This doesn't make any sense. That was their initial negative response. So I went over there, told them, and they said, hey, great. You know what? This is actually true. You know, a lot of the HR leaders said, no, this is what happens. People come in and they get bad reviews. They come in, they get their money. They come in, they can't face another peak, and they're out. It was letting the data tell the story. It was about, look, this is what happened. This is, instead of just measuring metrics and looking at when people actually leave, which is helpful, let's talk about when they're actually leaving. And this gave us a whole set of tools to work with. But this was important. This was be able to take data and information from a slightly different angle, a little bit more people-centric, customer-centric, and show them what was going on with what was actually happening. So very different story, give you an idea. All right, let's talk about some of these other problems and the way analytics can help solve problems. So this is what I call the classic. I mentioned this at the beginning. This is the classic. We need more candidates. So when we think about it, look, there's a process and there's the throughput. You know, who we source, who we screen, who we make offers to, and we get down to the offer. That's where we're really trying to go, right? We really want to make that process happen. So I had a group in my client there at this large e-commerce company, and they were saying we need more candidates. So they were talking about software engineers with experience, and they weren't getting the hiring volume that they needed, and they couldn't understand why. Their immediate assumption was they weren't seeing enough. They needed more candidate volume, and that was the problem, if they could just get more people. So they had a process involved that was pretty straightforward. You know, there's the applicant pool, you know, the talent pool, referrals, applicants, the talent pool with phone screening, an on-site panel, moving right to offer. One of the great opportunities at this organization is that they move very quickly. Some people have asked me about their average time from application to offer, and I've given them numbers. I say, look, in some cases, it was as fast as 8-9 days. They would move from application to screening to interview to offer for less than 10 days, which typically is met with a level of just, that's incredible, there's no way. And I say, look, this is what happens when you have a great process. You move very, very quickly, or you are able to if you wish. And this is what we saw. You know, we saw 20, for every 20 to 40 candidates on a given time period, we'd see maybe 8 to 12 phone screens, 2 to 3 on-site offer, you know, on-site screens, and 1 or 2 offers. So a pretty high offer success rate from the panel, a not so great ratio from phone screen to on-site, and a not so great process from referrals, applicants, and internal candidates into the phone screen process. we started digging into the data. I wanted to understand what's happening here. I started looking at this data with the recruiters that were doing the work, with the hiring managers that were doing the work, with the interview teams. I wanted to understand what was really happening. We looked at this data from the applicant tracking tools, just to say, look, I want to see what the numbers look like. And this is we know the process, we see the numbers, and this is just the volume. This is what it is. Now, I could have simply reacted and said, hey, let's go source more people. And if we can up the sourcing, that'll be great. But when I think about advocating for the function, it's if I'm interviewing 20 people and only getting, you know, one or two or three or four of them through the process, there's something wrong with either the candidates or the process. So let's figure that out. And then maybe there's a learning curve for the recruiter or for the hiring managers. It's not just a question of numbers in that case if we're really looking to be successful. So we started driving this process. I said, okay, do we need more candidates? So we started ramping up the referrals. We started loosening some of the submitting requirements. We talked with the hiring managers and the screens, and we started to increase the people that were being submitted to get a validation. Say, look, let's start talking to more people and let's drive that, see if that works. If that's the problem, if we need more candidates, that, you know, if we're being too harsh at the screening and the top of the funnel, maybe we can increase this process and change it. And we didn't see it. We saw the referrals moving. We saw that. We saw some uptick, but we didn't see enough. We didn't see what was happening that we should see doubling, tripling, and moving forward. It just didn't move the needle enough. And it was becoming a real issue. The managers were starting to say, look, we don't have the talent. We need to drive this forward. And this happened over just a matter of a few weeks. So when we started looking at the process, we started driving into these different things. And what we realized was that the difference in the process wasn't the candidate pool, it wasn't the recruiters, it wasn't the offers, and it wasn't the panel. The only thing that was different when we compared it to every other hiring process in the organization that was similar were the phone screens. That was the only thing that was different. Applicant pool, very similar. We saw candidates that would move from one group, move into this group, would also move into other groups and be much more successful at a much higher rate. We saw on-site panels, similar interviewers, you know, interview four or five interviewers doing technical interviewing for one group were doing it for this group as well. They were the same panelists. And the offers, very structured. There isn't a lot of difference. The pay structure is very much the same. So when it's all the same, it can't be those things. But the big difference were the individuals and the style of the phone screening that was being done. Candidates being moved forward, et cetera. So we tested that. This was the experiment, was to say, hey, if the applicants are basically the same, panels the same, offers the same, let's remove the phone screen from the process. Now that was sensitive. So what we did was we had a little bit of a scientific experiment. We said, hey, let's do this. Let's talk about taking the phone screens and move that forward. Let's take these people through the phone screen, but let's remove the outcome. If they don't pass the phone screen or they pass it, let's just move them to onsite. If they're meeting minimum qualifications to be phone screen, let's understand what that is. And so we did 20. We did a very small pilot. We coordinated this with the VPs. We said, look, we're going to do this. We took the 20 people that phone screened and we moved them forward to onsite panels. And it was crazy. We went from, you know, we had a lot of people that hit the phone screen that were strongly inclined. They said, look, we need to hire this person. The phone screener was really on board. And we had some where the phone screener said, no, this person's no good. I would never hire them. It went to onsite panels, absolutely no correlation. A bunch of people that were strongly inclined by the phone screeners did not get an offer from the panel. And a bunch of people that the screener said, no way, this person's not good, sailed through the panel and got offers. It was, we basically demonstrated with the first pilot that the phone screen was irrelevant to the outcome of the panel decisions, and that we needed to figure out what was going on. Once we figured that out with the data, then we realized that it's not about not doing phone screens, it's about figuring out what's wrong with those phone screens so we can really be efficient. We did some deep dives, we listened to the phone screens, we had recruiters shadow the phone screeners, we changed the phone screeners, we pulled every single lever we could in that process, and we wound up getting a significantly better outcome. It was really about what's happening and what we did. So this is it. We looked at the data. We had candidate profiles, steps in the process, each step, the players. We had some hypotheses. We had the managers. We're making too few offers because we're seeing too few candidates. We had other phone screeners and interviewers. These candidates aren't good enough for our needs. They won't make it here. That's mostly the phone screeners. And then we had the recruiters. the results seem kind of random. We can't tell which candidates will succeed. We just can't correlate. We feel good, they don't make it. We don't think they're that great. We take a shot and they make it. So the question was, how do we get more offers accepted? That's where we came through. What are we doing here? And that's when we drove the process. We looked at the recruiters. They're doing the same thing. Some of the recruiters were overlapping, so that wasn't them. We looked at the candidates. Same candidate pool. No, it's not them. We looked at the hiring teams. Again, same kinds of hiring processes, same managers, similar groups, similar teams, not a lot of difference. We looked at the panels. Same panelists, oftentimes overlapping, same outcomes, but with different outcomes. The only group that was left were the phone interviewers. It was really that whole Sherlock Holmes thing of, you know, when you remove the impossible, whatever is left, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. And that's where we focused on the effort. We went from getting one candidate offer from about 35 or 40 candidates to 4 offers for every 10 candidates that were submitted. It's a huge, huge shift. It was really, really powerful. And it was because we helped fix the problem at hand. Once we did that, we were able to say, hey, look, this is what we're doing. With that process in play, with our data, with really collaborating, we move that forward. And I think the best part about that was we didn't just assume that it was a volume problem. We were given the opportunity to use data and drive that forward. So that's where that ended up. Phone interviewers, we fixed that problem and we moved it forward. So it was coming back to that group with, no, we don't need more candidates in and of itself. We need better selection. So by changing the phone screens, by driving that process, we're able to really use, you know, really analyze what was going on. And we couldn't just do that with metrics. The data, the pipeline, the data flow that we had showed us where the problem might be, gave us a theory. The anecdotes showed us that we were onto something, that it wasn't just candidate flow. So keep that in mind as we talk about this next one. So here's the question. Is COVID impacting our critical hires? This is a much more recent example. This was just a question of, hey, look, we're in the quarter. We've got all this COVID-19 happening. We've got this horrible situation around the world. It must be, you know, there must be something going on. Are we thinking about it? That was the question that came from one of my great HR partners was, are we dealing with this and are we ahead of the curve? Are we going to be reacting to this or are we ahead of it? And my comment was, well, what do you think is going on? What's the theory? What do you expect to be happening? Because I could just tell you, but it would just be a question of me saying something and then you arguing with it or maybe bouncing it off. And this is the comment that came back. The idea was that from the leadership team was, well, with so many companies cutting and laying off and closing, we must be getting a ton of traction in our hiring. We've got a great brand, we've got good comp, and we have an opportunity. You know, we should be seeing a lot more hiring going on and a lot easier to get people through the process, right? I mean, we're the only game in town or we're doing better or whatever that is, what's happening? So started with that anecdotal collection and I had the information in the spreadsheet, but I saw some things, but I didn't want to just jump to a conclusion and start off with a point of view. I wanted to get that data question going. And I had the anecdotes. So I started talking with my team members. Some of them said, yeah, we're definitely getting more interest. More people are expressing interest or more actively engaged because of what's going on. But then I heard this other comment. I love this phrase, buyers are becoming shoppers. People that they felt were suddenly very interested in taking a job, suddenly were moving into, well, let me think about it, or let me interview other places. That really struck me. I was like, okay, that's a big deal. And then I saw this one. A few recruiters mentioned, I'm seeing a lot more withdrawals. People are calling, saying they're not interested in moving forward, or they're maybe getting an offer, not declining it. Or dropping out. It was the idea that people were withdrawing, which was a surprise. They should be increasing and driving more and maybe getting more and more driven, but we're seeing more withdrawals. And then lastly, some of the folks were saying, look, I had offers in the table, but it was around my offer getting declined or people are negotiating, taking longer, all these things. It was a very different set of anecdotes than what the assumption was. Now we could have ended it there. We could have said, hey, look, this is what's happening. This is the anecdotes. We're seeing slower. We're seeing less. We're seeing this. This is the opportunity we're driving for. So we have this strong brand where we're getting more interest, but there's a perception of risk and maybe the opportunity isn't what we think it is. So what's going on? So what I wanted to be able to do, the deliverable here was I couldn't just go back and write an essay I couldn't say, hey, look, this is what's going on, and this is going back to the executive team to be an agenda item on their weekly meeting. They just, you know, the question is, hey, is COVID impacting our critical hires? And rather than just saying yes or no, or giving some long-winded answer, it was about how are we gonna visualize that data? Without it, it's just a recruiter's anecdote versus executive theory. And for those of you who've been to that wrestling match, when you see the recruiter's anecdote and executive theory usually wins if you don't have good data. So there's a classic dashboard. This is data that's provided to us on a regular basis. We see this. It's a really powerful set of Excel with slicers and metrics and dashboards, et cetera. It's an effective tool. You can basically dive into anything you want. But I noticed something. When you look at the data behind it, there's a ton of data that's not used. It's just not in there. And so what I did was I started looking at some of the other data points and the time, et cetera, and say, look, what's this data doing for us? And this is when I want to talk a little bit about Excel. I'm not a scientist who does big algorithms and math and all. I like math and engineering. I'm all about it, but I'm not an expert in the field. But Excel has some things that have really, I think, helped out quite a bit. If you look at if you open up an Excel spreadsheet with the latest versions, you'll notice way off in the upper left corner, it's got this great ideas tool. And this is, I think, going to help everybody become a pocket analyst more and more. It's not so much giving you the answers, but it is giving you inspiration. That ideas button is really important. I'm sure many of you have seen it, many of you have used it, but it's inspirational because when you've got this much unused data, you can start getting, when you click on that, it's going to look at your data for you. It's just going to do the algorithms in the background, and it's going to start giving you these thoughts about, you know, maybe 35 or 40 ideas. Hey, look, this is data that you have from your ATS or from your system. And these are some of the things that I noticed, and it gives you the charts, it gives you the visualization. These aren't necessarily the data you're going to use, but they're inspirational. They can say, hey, I think this is really important. This is what we really want to move forward to. You see, look, positions remaining calculated has outliers, proposed start dates, 4-1, 7-1. It's showing me, hey, look, there's a big difference here. Something's happening in the start dates. And that was when I started, it kind of inspired me to look at this information to say, oh, okay, now that I see what's happening. So here's some of the data I had, 300 plus line items with timestamps in the process. I was able to say, look, that got me thinking, if start dates are extending, what else is moving? And this is what happened. When I looked at data from pre-COVID, I looked at all the steps in the process. These are the average days. So before, it was about 65 days total when you look at things from the recruiter screen all the way to the offer process and onboarding. When you look at post-COVID, all that data, we saw it increase to 100 days, from 65 to 100 days on average. But that's from your screen all the way to start date. And then we look at the impact. That's a 36-day increase in average projection. So we're looking at people moving all the way across the process. So we had some speed. The recommending for interview, the first interview, the second interview, the offer extensions, they actually got faster. You know, a lot of things really got, you know, a lot better, you know, half a day on average, a full day on average, you know, really, really quick. We were competing well in the process. But there was also a lot of things that were moving a lot slower. Recruiter screens ticked up quite a bit, and that was because of the increased volume of applicants. It took more time to screen them. You saw offer approvals taking longer. You saw offer accepts and pre-boards and start dates really extending. People were basically saying, hey, look, this is the problem. It's not that we are seeing more candidates, but we're taking longer to get the offers approved. We're taking a little bit longer to get them accepted. Candidates were taking longer to think about the jobs. And then we had this, the pre-board was taking longer. They're saying, hey, look, I need more time to do this, et cetera. So you can start to see, it wasn't that people weren't interested, but they were risk averse. They're like, do I really want to change jobs now? Do I want to move from company A to company B in this environment? Or what's going on? That helped us really change the conversation. So it wasn't a recruiting issue per se in terms of sourcing. It was a whole process issue of how do we assure, how do we drive, what levers do we pull to get people really driven forward. So that's it. You see, this was the theory. Applications would skyrocket, offers would skyrocket, starts would skyrocket. I was able to use those tables to do that and show them this. This is a version of what I gave the team. I said, look, there's your theory, what we thought would happen. This is what's actually happening. an increase in applications, it's a ramp up. An increase in offers, it's a ramp up. But starts are actually dropping because people are pushing out their start. And then some of them are withdrawing. So we're seeing better volume. We're seeing better offers to an extent. But the fact is, we're not getting on board as quickly as we need. That helps set the conversation for, okay, how do we improve starts? How do we get people to start faster? What levers do we need to pull? Advantages, features, whatever that is. It moved from a recruiting conversation to an onboarding conversation about how do we actually build that better? And we're able to do that with data. That's how that was able to be done. So visualizing it was important. Using just readily available data in Excel, some of the easy tools to get inspiration, helped me do this. Helped me just get to a point where I was able to do this. And honestly, I probably could have done this on a napkin note. I didn't need to necessarily use fancy charts or graphics. It's nicer, it looks nicer, but just to be able to say, hey, look, here's your application flow, here's your offers, and here's your starts. Everybody would have like, oh, okay, so how can we solve that problem? But you know, that's really what it took it down to. Big data, looking for something anomalous, looking for a trend, investigating that, and then moving it forward. Once we saw that, I added this in. I said, look, some of our traditional KPIs, if we just leverage those, time to offer, time to accept, you know, NPS scores, offer accept rates, they were all, you know, green. They were looking good over time. But the offer accept to start date was dragging out, and the withdrawal data was going up in a bad way. So once we started looking at this integrated idea and analyzing it, we're able to change the entire conversation to be a lot different. So I'm going to wrap things up here. We're getting close to the end of our time here. And I think, you know, talk about tools and analytics. There are a ton of tools. They're all what they are. They're good. They're bad. They're great. They're whatever. They require different levels of sophistication. They do different things. I use these four examples because these get bandied about quite a bit. There's R, which is a popular free software programming language. It's used in statistical computing and graphics. It's popular. It's well known. It's relatively easy to access and use. There's Tableau software. You know, none of these are endorsements. They're just examples that you'll see. It's interactive data visualization. It's really helpful to have those data sets. There's our great friend in Microsoft Excel, which is, you know, it's ever popular and everybody uses it. The most common expression I hear in finance, analytics, talent is, well, let's export it into Excel and go from there. So that, you know, it's really just the baseline and the floor for what's going on. And honestly, if you've got access to it, do it. And then there's tools like Python and programming languages. Now, Python's free, it's open source, it's an object-oriented scripting language, and it gets used quite a bit in building great analytics tools and mechanisms. So depending on your level of interest, commitment, and technical acumen, these are some of the tools you can use. And then, you know, if you just do some basic searches on some of these different tools that are available, I just did a screenshot and put it over there on the right. These are different tools that are available. They help. They're useful. You've probably seen many of them. But it's really around being able to take data and help build your narrative and help tell that story. So with that, we only have about 2 minutes left, so I apologize for that. But I'd love to go from there, Stacey. If there's questions or things people want to know more about, I'm happy to do that.
Hey there, Todd. I think that was fantastic. Do you want to unshare your screen and we'll just bring it to the two of us and we'll wrap it up here. We had almost 60 viewers participating on the Facebook Live, and some of the questions on there, I mean, like mostly it was just like listening to you going, wow, this is superbly interesting. I had a few questions as we're going through there, if you wouldn't mind. And maybe I missed it because I was going through and checking the chat, so it was hard to kind of listen and go back and forth. Sure. But when you were talking about the phone screens and changing that portion in the phone screens, mm-hmm. I was wondering, because I know there's been all this talk about bringing bots in to do those initial phone screens, but I was wondering if the problem with the phone screeners was that maybe they were rude, they were short, maybe they didn't have the right questions that they were asking, or maybe the process was too long and people were just, I'm out of here. What was really wrong with the phone screens?
What we learned from the phone screens, it's a great question. Luckily, nobody was rude. Nobody was, you know, that sort of thing. They were very professional. Sure. But what we found was there were two things happening. One was they had these sort of, my coding is better than yours approach. They would be giving problems to people or coding examples in these screens that were very difficult to solve and very specific. And so if the person couldn't solve the problem, to their satisfaction, they would rate them poorly. And that's a very opinionated idea. To say, imagine this, if I were to, all of us have been on this call now for an hour. What if I were to say, okay, what's the square root of 300,747.2? Oh, you don't know. Okay.
I was told there would be no math.
Right. Exactly. And you're like, okay. But the other challenge was the other challenge was a little bit of bias. Some of the things were, it was the choice. The question was, hey, here's a problem we want to solve. Let's whiteboard this. Use whatever method you want. And then the feedback would be, oh, well, they chose method A, and I don't like that. I prefer method B. And it's like, well, then why did you say use whatever method you want? And they're like, well, because we don't want to make that uncomfortable. And I said, but so you're one of the descriptors. I said, let me put it this way. You're playing, I'm thinking of a number with the candidate. And when they say 11 and you say, oh, I really like the number 8, that's not a question that can be answered fairly. So it's a question of what are you assessing? Are you assessing their ability to code, their ability to collaborate, or their ability to fail?
Yeah.
Their ability
to think like me.
Yes. And there were examples where some candidates would get, maybe there were some examples of what you might call bias. They would look at a resume before a phone screen and say, oh, that school's no good, or I'm not familiar with that school, or things like that. But we, at the recruiting team and our partnership, we were able to say, look, this person demonstrated ability and you should talk with them. And that's why we want this to happen. This is a great opportunity for their technical skills. So we were able to mitigate some of that, but it was really just around the way that they approached the problem solving.
The other question I had was a lot of these data reports can come from applicant tracking systems, right? I mean, there's certainly like you can pull your metrics, but again, we want to get beyond just like the metrics and the weekly reports and like talk about how you can actually look at data to make informed decisions and create these descriptive, predictive, prescriptive reports and analyze those. Do you feel that, I don't know if you use applicant, I'm sure you use applicant tracking systems, but in your experience of pulling those, are they limited in the way that you can pull that data? And do you actually have to go out to other sources to pull data that is beyond the applicant tracking system?
Yeah, I say this a lot to people. So people say to me, they ask me, what's the best applicant tracking system, or are there good ones, or is one better? And sure, there's some that are, they're really good, but I always tell them it's not the ATS, it's the configuration. It's your process. What are you doing and how are you capturing it? If I had a dime for every time someone told me, oh, well, we do 3 interviews, and I say, okay, great, 3, but the system only tracks 2. And you're like, oh, well, because, some crazy idea. So there's one example where I noticed, I was asked about diversity of applicants. Like, can you show me a report of the EEO data for the US applicants? I looked at the ATS and there was none. And when I looked into it at that organization, they had just configured a new ATS about maybe 6 months before, and they hadn't chosen the EEO question. They just hadn't activated it. And I said, so we don't have that data. And they were, the leadership was under the impression that it was impossible to get or difficult to get. And I said, no, I just clicked the box. And so now give me a quarter as we get applicant data and we'll start to collect it. We'll see, fairly collected, compliant EOE data, and we can see, let's get some data on how we're doing. And it was really just a question of that. Now on the data extraction, yes, some tools have much better data reporting and data extraction tools. And you need to maybe use some different features or environments, like some of these export tools and all that. And that's what I was mentioning earlier. A lot of times you just get tables and all these flat file transfers, and you put them in Excel to start doing the analytics in the tool. So I would say that many of them, you need to start thinking about what does the process look like? How configured is your ATS, and how accurately does it reflect the actual process? And then once you have those steps coordinated and the stages and all those information in your ATS, you can really start to figure out, what are we doing well? Are we interviewing quickly enough? Are we giving feedback quickly enough? That was one of the examples I used at Amazon was to help sort of benchmark. I said, look, when candidates get their final interviews and an offer decision at that company, they typically know the outcome within 24 hours. They know maybe, well, many times I would have recruiters on my team calling candidates that afternoon, the next morning, to let them know what the outcome was. It was very fast. It was this idea of how do we do that? And that was tracked in the system. When the recruiter would make the phone call and update, it would boom, it would timestamp it. So we could see, I could look at that data and say, hey, look, this was the date of the interview. And here's the day that it was updated with the out with the communication to the candidate. This is the time difference. You know, if we have a service level agreement, an SLA of 24 hours, and those numbers are outside 24, it's a defect. We couldn't do that if we weren't timestamping it. You know, it would all be anecdotal. So that's important, is to understand how accurately is the process that you use configured into the ATS if it's capable of doing it. And how important is that to you?
That collaboration of your technology is so key, because data entry, if it's bad, it's going to have a bad outcome. So, you know, Todd, we are a little bit past the time. I mean, I could sit here all day and just ask you questions, but we would love to have you back on the show another time. And of course, you know, you're on my board of advisors, so we talk all the time. So I really appreciate your time today. This has been so informative, and we'll have the recap and the replay of this on our YouTube channel for anybody who'd like to watch it again. I know, like, I would love to watch this again and just take notes. You can find that on the Tech Recruit YouTube channel. And you can also find more information on all of our shows at techrecruit.io. Every Tuesday at 9 a.m., we have Dueling Sourcers. Next week will be Dean DaCosta and Steve Levy. And then we'll be back next Wednesday at 9 a.m. with Talent Analytics, and we're going to be talking about the same stuff. We're going to talk about how data transforms organizations and change management. And then every Thursday at 1 p.m., and of course, this is all Pacific time because I'm in Los Angeles, we're going to be having a job seeker Q&A. If you're on the job market and you're looking for support with other job seekers, you need mentorship, you have questions, you want to talk to recruiters, we're here to help. Other than that, everybody, you have a great week, and we'll see you next time. Thank you so much, Todd.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.